This is disc number 5.
The colonel knelt down beside me and put his lips to the coffin and whispered, "I am sorry, Alaska. You deserved a better friend." Is it so hard to die, Mr. Lewis? Is that labyrinth really worse than this one? 7 days after. I spent the next day in our room, playing football on mute, at once unable to do nothing and unable to do anything much. It was Martin Luther King Day, our last day before classes started again, and I could think of nothing but having killed her. The colonel spent the morning with me, but then decided to go to the cafeteria for meatloaf.
"Let's go," he said.
"Not hungry."
"You have to eat."
"Want to bet?" I said, without looking up from the game.
"Christ, fine."
He sighed and left, slamming the door behind him. He's still very angry, I found myself thinking with a bit of pity. No reason to be angry. Anger just distracts from the all-encompassing sadness, the frank knowledge that you killed her and robbed her of a future and a life. Getting pissed wouldn't fix it. Damn it. "How's the meatloaf?" I asked the colonel when he returned.
"About as you remember it. Neither meaty nor loafy."
The colonel sat down next to me.
"The eagle ate with me. He wanted to know if we set off the fireworks."
I paused the game and turned to him. With one hand, he picked at one of the last remaining pieces of blue vinyl on our foam couch. "And you said?" I asked.
"I didn't rat. Anyway, he said her aunt or something is coming tomorrow to clean out her room. So if there's anything that's ours or anything her aunt wouldn't want to find..."
I turned back to the game and said, "I'm not up for it today."
"Then I'll do it alone," he answered.
He turned and walked outside, leaving the door open, and the bitter remnants of the cold snap quickly overwhelmed the radiator. So I paused the game and stood up to close the door, and when I peeked around the corner to see if the colonel had entered her room, he was standing there, just outside our door, and he grabbed onto my sweatshirt, smiled, and said,
"I knew you wouldn't make me do that alone. I knew it."
I shook my head and rolled my eyes, but followed him down the sidewalk, past the payphone, and into her room. I hadn't thought of her smell since she died, but when the colonel opened the door, I caught the edge of her scent, wet dirt and grass and cigarette smoke, and beneath that, the vestiges of vanilla-scented skin lotion. She flooded into my present, and only tact kept me from burying my face in the dirty laundry overfilling the hamper by her dresser. It looked as I remembered it, hundreds of books stacked against the walls, her lavender comforter crumpled at the foot of her bed, a precarious stack of books on her bedside table, her volcanic candle just peeking out from beneath the bed. It looked as I knew it would, but the smell, unmistakably her, shocked me. I stood in the center of the room, my eyes shut, inhaling slowly through my nose, the vanilla and the uncut autumn grass. But with each slow breath, the smell faded as I became accustomed to it, and soon she was gone again. "This is unbearable," I said matter-of-factly, because it was. "God, these books she'll never read, her life's library."
"Bought at garage sales and now probably destined for another one."
"Ashes to ashes, garage sale to garage sale," I said.
"Right, okay, down to business. Get anything her aunt wouldn't want to find," the colonel said,
and I saw him kneeling at her desk, the drawer beneath her computer pulled open, his small fingers pulling out groups of stapled papers.
"Christ, she kept every paper she ever wrote. Moby Dick, Ethan Frome."
I reached between her mattress and box spring for the condoms I knew she hid for Jake's visits. I pocketed them, and then went over to her dresser, searching through her underwear for hidden bottles of liquor or sex toys or God knows what. I found nothing. And then I settled on the books, staring at them stacked on their sides, spines out, the haphazard collection of literature that was Alaska. There was one book I wanted to take with me, but I couldn't find it. The colonel was sitting on the floor next to her bed, his head bent toward the floor, looking under her bed frame.
"She sure didn't leave any booze, did she?" he asked.
And I almost said she buried it in the woods out by the soccer field, but I realized that the colonel didn't know. that she never took him to the edge of the woods and told him to dig for buried treasure, that she and I had shared that alone, and I kept it for myself like a keepsake, as if sharing the memory might lead to its dissipation. "Do you see the general in his labyrinth anywhere?" I asked while scanning the titles on the book spines. "It has a lot of green on the cover, I think. It's a paperback, and it got flooded, so the pages are probably bloated, but I don't think she..." And then he cut me off with, "Yeah, it's right here." And I turned around, and he was holding it, the pages fanned out like an accordion, from Longwell Jeff and Kevin's prank, and I walked over to him and took it and sat down on her bed. The places she'd underlined and the little notes she'd written had all been blurred out by the soaking, but the book was still mostly readable, and I was thinking I would take it back to my room and try to read it, even though it wasn't a biography, when I flipped to that page toward the back. He was shaken by the overwhelming revelation that the headlong race between his misfortunes and his dreams was at that moment reaching the finish line. The rest was darkness. "Damn it," he sighed. "How will I ever get out of this labyrinth?" The whole passage was underlined in bleeding, water-soaked black ink, but there was another ink, this one a crisp blue post-flood, and an arrow led from "How will I ever get out of this labyrinth?" to a margin note written in her loop-heavy cursive, "Straight and fast." "Hey, she wrote something in here after the flood," I said, "but it's weird. Look, page 192. I tossed the book to the colonel, and he flipped to the page, and then looked up at me. "Straight and fast," he said. "Yeah. Weird, huh? The way out of the labyrinth, I guess." "Wait, how did it happen? What happened?" And because there was only one it, I knew to what he was referring. "I told you what the eagle told me. A truck jackknifed on the road. A cop car showed up to stop traffic, and she ran into the cop car. She was so drunk she didn't even swerve."
"So drunk?
So drunk? The cop car would have had its lights on." "Pudge, she ran into a cop car that had its lights on," he said hurriedly. "Straight and fast. Straight and fast out of the labyrinth." "No," I said, but even as I said it, I could see it. I could see her drunk enough and pissed off enough. About what? About cheating on Jake? About hurting me? About wanting me and not him? Still pissed about ratting out Mariah? I could see her staring down the cop car and aiming for it, not giving a shit about anyone else, not thinking of her promise to me, not thinking of her father or anyone, and that bitch, she killed herself. But no, that was not her. No, she said to be continued. Of course.
No.
"Yeah, you're probably right," the colonel said. He dropped the book, sat down on the bed next to me, and put his forehead in his hands.
"Who drives 6 miles off campus to kill herself? Doesn't make any sense. But straight and fast? Bit of an odd premonition, isn't it? And we still don't really know what happened, if you think about it. Where she was going, why, who called? Someone called, right? Or did I make..." And the colonel kept talking, puzzling it out while I picked up the book and found my way to that page where the general's headlong race came to its end, and we were both stuck in our heads, the distance between us unbridgeable, and I could not listen to the colonel because I was busy trying to get the last hints of her smell, busy telling myself that of course she hadn't done it. It was me. I had done it. And so had the colonel. He could try to puzzle his way out of it, but I knew better, knew that we could never be anything but wholly, unforgivably guilty. 8 days after. Tuesday, we had school for the first time. Madame O'Malley had a moment of silence at the beginning of French class, a class that was always punctuated with long moments of silence, and then asked us how we were feeling.
"Awful," a girl said. "En français," Madame O'Malley replied. "En français."
Everything looked the same, but more still. The weekday warriors still sat on the benches outside the library, but their gossip was quiet, understated. The cafeteria clamored with the sounds of plastic trays against wooden tables and forks scraping plates, but any conversations were muted. but more than the noiselessness of everyone else was the silence where she should have been, the bubbling, bursting, storytelling Alaska. But instead, it felt like those times when she had withdrawn into herself, like she was refusing to answer how or why questions, only this time for good. The colonel sat down next to me in religion class, sighed, and said, "You reek of smoke, Pudge. Ask me if I give a shit." Dr. Hyde shuffled into class then, our final exams stacked underneath one arm. He sat down, took a series of labored breaths, and began to talk.
"It is a law that parents should not have to bury their children," he said, "and someone should enforce it. This semester, we're going to continue studying the religious traditions to which you were introduced this fall. But there's no doubting that the questions we'll be asking have more immediacy now than they did just a few days ago. What happens to us after we die, for instance, is no longer a question of idle philosophical interest. It is a question we must ask about our classmate. And how to live in the shadow of grief is not something nameless Buddhists, Christians, and Muslims have to explore. The questions of religious thought have become, I suspect, personal."
He shuffled through our exams, pulling one out from the pile before him.
"I have here Alaska's final. You'll recall that you were asked what the most important question facing people is, and how the three traditions we're studying this year address that question. This was Alaska's question."
With a sigh, he grabbed hold of his chair and lifted himself out of it, then wrote on the blackboard, "How will we ever get out of this labyrinth of suffering? A.Y.
"I'm going to leave that up for the rest of the semester," he said, "because everybody who has ever lost their way in life has felt the nagging insistence of that question. At some point, we all look up and realize we are lost in a maze, and I don't want us to forget Alaska. And I don't want to forget that even when the material we study seems boring, we're trying to understand how people have answered that question, and the questions each of you posed in your papers. How different traditions have come to terms with what Chip, in his final, called people's rotten lots in life."
Hyde sat down.
"So, how are you guys doing?"
The colonel and I said nothing, while a bunch of people who didn't know Alaska extolled her virtues and professed to be devastated, and at first it bothered me. I didn't want the people she didn't know and the people she didn't like to be sad. They'd never cared about her, and now they were carrying on as if she were a sister. But I guess I didn't know her completely either. If I had, I'd have known what she meant by "to be continued." And if I had cared about her as I should have, as I thought I did, how could I have let her go? So they didn't bother me, really. But next to me, the colonel breathed slowly and deeply through his nose like a bull about to charge. He actually rolled his eyes when weekday warrior Brooke Blakely, whose parents had received a progress report courtesy of Alaska, said,
"I'm just sad I never told her I loved her. I just don't understand why."
"That's such bullshit," the colonel said as we walked to lunch, "as if Brooke Blakely gives two shits about Alaska."
"If Brooke Blakely died, wouldn't you be sad?" I asked.
"I guess, but I wouldn't bemoan the fact that I never told her I loved her. I don't love her. She's an idiot."
I thought everyone else had a better excuse to grieve than we did. After all, they hadn't killed her. But I knew better than to try to talk to the colonel when he was mad. 9 days after.
"I've got a theory," the colonel said as I walked in the door after a miserable day of classes.
The cold had begun to let up, but word had not spread to whoever ran the furnaces, so the classrooms were all stuffy and overheated, and I just wanted to crawl into bed and sleep until the time came to do it all over again. "Missed you in class today," I noted as I sat down on my bed. The colonel sat at his desk, hunched over a notebook. I lay down on my back and pulled the covers up over my head, but the colonel was undiscouraged.
"Right, well, I was busy coming up with the theory, which isn't terribly likely, admittedly, but it's plausible, so listen. She kisses you. That night, someone calls. Jake, I imagine. They have a fight about cheating or about something else, who knows. So she's upset, and she wants to go see him. She comes back to the room crying, and she tells us to help her get off campus. And she's freaked out because, I don't know, let's say because if she can't go visit him, Jake will break up with her. That's just a hypothetical reason. So she gets off campus, drunk and all pissed off, and she's furious at herself over whatever it is. And she's driving along, and she sees the cop car. And then in a flash, everything comes together. And the end to her labyrinthine mystery is staring her right in the face. And she just does it, straight and fast, just aims at the cop car and never swerves. Not because she's drunk, but because she killed herself.
That's ridiculous. She wasn't thinking about Jake or fighting with Jake. She was making out with me. I tried to bring up the whole Jake thing, but she just shushed me.
So who called her?
I kicked off my comforter, and my fist balled, smashed my hand against the wall with each syllable as I said, "I don't know. And you know what? It doesn't matter. She's dead. Is the brilliant colonel going to figure out something that's going to make her less freaking dead?" But it did matter, of course, which is why I kept pounding at our cinder block walls, and why the questions had floated beneath the surface for a week. Who'd called? What was wrong? Why did she leave? Jake had not gone to her funeral, nor had he called us to say he was sorry or to ask us what happened. He had just disappeared, and of course I had wondered. I had wondered if she had any intention of keeping her promise that we would be continued. I had wondered who called and why, and what made her so upset. But I'd rather wonder than get answers I couldn't live with.
"Maybe she was driving there to break up with Jake then," the colonel said, his voice suddenly edgeless.
He sat down on the corner of my bed. "I don't know. I don't really want to know."
"Yeah, well," he said, "I want to know. Because if she knew what she was doing, Pudge, she made us accomplices. And I hate her for that. I mean, God, look at us. We can't even talk to anyone anymore. So listen, I wrote out a game plan. 1, talk to eyewitnesses. 2, figure out how drunk she was. 3, figure out where she was going and why."
"I don't want to talk to Jake," I said half-heartedly, already resigned to the colonel's incessant planning. "If he knows, I definitely don't want to talk to him. And if he doesn't, I don't want to pretend like it didn't happen." The colonel stood up and sighed.
"You know what, Pudge? I feel bad for you, I do. I know you kissed her, and I know you're broken up about it. But honestly, shut up. If Jake knows, you're not going to make it any worse. And if he doesn't, he won't find out. So just stop worrying about your goddamn self for 1 minute and think about your dead friend." "Sorry. Long day."
"It's fine," I said, pulling the covers back over my head. "It's fine," I repeated. "And whatever. It was fine. It had to be. I couldn't afford to lose the colonel." 13 days after. Because our main source of vehicular transportation was interred in Vine Station, Alabama, the colonel and I were forced to walk to the Pelham Police Department to search for eyewitnesses. We left after eating dinner in the cafeteria, the night falling fast and early, and trudged up Highway 119 for 1.5 miles before coming to a single-story stucco building situated between a Waffle House and a gas station. Inside, a long desk that rose to the colonel's solar plexus separated us from the police station proper, which seemed to consist of 3 uniformed officers sitting at 3 desks, all of them talking on the phone.
"I'm Alaska Young's brother," the colonel announced brazenly, "and I want to talk to the cop who saw her die."
A pale, thin man with a reddish-blonde beard spoke quickly into the phone and then hung up.
"I seen her," he said. "She hit my cruiser." "Can we talk to you outside?" the colonel asked.
"Yep."
The cop grabbed a coat and walked toward us, and as he approached, I could see the blue veins through the translucent skin of his face. For a cop, he didn't seem to get out much. Once outside, the colonel lit a cigarette.
"You 19?
The cop asked. "In Alabama, you can get married at 18, 14 with mom and dad's permission, but you have to be 19 to smoke."
"So find me. I just need to know what you saw."
"I most always work from 6 to midnight, but I was covering the graveyard shift. We got a call about a jackknife truck, and I was only about a mile away, so I headed over, and I just pulled up. I was still in my cruiser, and I seen out the corner of my eye the headlights, and my lights was on, and I turned the siren on, but the lights just kept coming straight at me, son, and I got out quick and run off, and she just barreled into me. I seen plenty, but I ain't never seen that. She didn't turn, she didn't break, she just hit it. I wasn't more than 10 feet from the cruiser when she hit it. I thought I'd die, but here I am."
For the first time, the colonel's theory seemed plausible. She didn't hear the siren. She didn't see the lights. She was sober enough to kiss well, I thought. Surely she was sober enough to swerve.
"Did you see her face before she hit the car? Was she asleep?" the colonel asked.
"That I can't tell you. I didn't see her. There wasn't much time."
"I understand. She was dead when you got to the car?" he asked.
I did everything I could. I run right up to her, but the steering wheel... Well, I reached in there, thought if I could get the steering wheel loose, but there wasn't no getting her out of that car alive. It fairly well crushed her chest, see?"
I winced at the image. "Did she say anything?" I asked.
"She was passed on, son," he said, shaking his head, and my last hope of last words faded.
"Do you think it was an accident?" the colonel asked as I stood beside him, my shoulders slouching, wanting a cigarette but nervous to be as audacious as him.
"I've been an officer here 26 years, and I've seen more drunks than you can count, and I ain't never seen someone so drunk they can't swerve. But I don't know. The coroner said it was an accident, and maybe it was. That ain't my field, you know. I suppose that's between her and the Lord now."
"How drunk was she?" I asked. "Like, did they test her?"
"Yeah, her BAL was .24. That's drunk, certainly. That's a powerful drunk."
"Was there anything in the car?" the colonel asked. "Anything, like, unusual that you remember?"
"I remember them brochures from colleges, places in Maine and Ohio and Texas, and I thought to myself that girl must be from Culver Creek. And that was mighty sad. See a girl like that looking to go to college? That's a goddamn shame. And they's flowers. They was flowers in her back seat, like from a florist. Tulips."
Tulips? I thought immediately of the tulips Jake had sent her. "Were they white?" I asked.
"They sure was," the cop answered.
Why would she have taken his tulips with her? But the cop wouldn't have an answer for that one.
"I hope y'all find out whatever y'all's looking for. I have thought it over some, 'cause I never seen nothing like that before. I've thought hard on it, wondered if I'd have started up the cruiser real quick and drove it off if she'd have been all right. There might have been time. No knowing now. But it don't matter, to my mind, whether it were an accident or it weren't. It's a goddamn shame either way."
"There was nothing you could have done," the colonel said softly. "You did your job, and we appreciate it."
"Well, thanks. Y'all go along now and take care, and let me know if you have any other questions. This is my card if you need anything."
The colonel put the card in his fake leather wallet, and we walked towards home. "White tulips," I said. "Jake's tulips. Why?"
"One time last year, she and Takumi and I were at the smoking hole, and there was this little white daisy on the bank of the creek, and all of a sudden she just jumped waist deep into the water and waded across and grabbed it. She put it behind her ear, and when I asked her about it, she told me that her parents always put white flowers in her hair when she was little. Maybe she wanted to die with white flowers. Maybe she was going to return them to Jake," I said.
"Maybe, but that cop just shit sure convinced me that it might have been a suicide."
Maybe we should just let her be dead, I said, frustrated. It seemed to me that nothing we might find out would make anything any better, and I could not get the image of the steering wheel careening into her chest out of my mind, her chest fairly well crushed while she sucked for a last breath that would never come. And no, this was not making anything better. What if she did do it? I asked the colonel. We're not any less guilty. All it does is make her into this awful selfish bitch.
Christ, Pudge, do you even remember the person she actually was? Do you remember how she could be a selfish bitch? That was part of her, and you used to know it. It's like now you only care about the Alaska you made up.
I sped up, walking ahead of the colonel, silent. And he couldn't know, because he wasn't the last person she kissed, because he hadn't been left with an unkeepable promise, because he wasn't me. Screw this, I thought, and for the first time I imagined just going back home, ditching the great perhaps for the old comforts of school friends. Whatever their faults, I'd never known my school friends in Florida to die on me. After a considerable distance, the colonel jogged up to me and said,
I just want it to be normal again. You and me, normal, fun, just normal. And I feel like if we knew...
Okay, fine. I cut him off. Fine, we'll keep looking.
The colonel shook his head, but then he smiled. I have always appreciated your enthusiasm, Pudge, and I'm just going to go ahead and pretend you still have it until it comes back. Now let's go home and find out why people off themselves.
14 days after. Warning signs of suicide the colonel and I found on the web. Previous suicide attempts. Verbally threatening suicide. Giving away prized possessions. Collecting and discussing methods of suicide. Expressions of hopelessness and anger at oneself and or the world. Writing, talking, reading, and drawing about death and or depression. Suggesting that the person would not be missed if he/she were gone. Self-injury. Recent loss of a friend or family member through death or suicide. Sudden and dramatic decline in academic performance. Eating disorders, sleeplessness, excessive sleeping, chronic headaches. Use or increased use of mind-altering substances. Loss of interest in sex, hobbies, and other activities previously enjoyed. Alaska displayed two of those warning signs. She had lost, although not recently, her mother, and her drinking, always pretty steady, had definitely increased in the last month of her life. She did talk about dying, but it always seemed to be at least half kidding.
I make jokes about death all the time, the colonel said. I made a joke last week about hanging myself with my tie, and I'm not going to off myself, so that doesn't count. And she didn't give anything away, and she sure as hell didn't lose interest in sex. One would have to like sex an awful lot to make out with your scrawny ass.
Funny, I said.
I know. God, I'm a genius. And her grades were good, and I don't recall her talking about killing herself.
Once, with the cigarettes, remember? You smoke to enjoy it, I smoke to die.
That was a joke.
But when prodded by the colonel, maybe to prove to him that I could remember Alaska as she really was and not just as I wanted her to be, I kept returning the conversation to those times when she would be mean and moody, when she didn't feel like answering how, when, why, who, or what questions. She could seem so angry, I thought out loud.
What, and I can't? The colonel retorted. I'm plenty angry, Pudge, and you haven't been the picture of placidity of late either, and you aren't going to off yourself. Wait, are you?
No, I said. And maybe it was only because Alaska couldn't hit the brakes and I couldn't hit the accelerator. Maybe she just had an odd kind of courage that I lacked.
No. Good to know. So yeah, she was up and down, from fire and brimstone to smoke and ashes. But partly, this year at least, it was the whole Mariah thing. Look, Pudge, she obviously wasn't thinking about killing herself when she was making out with you. After that, she was asleep until the phone rang. So she decided to kill herself at some point between that ringing phone and crashing. Or it was an accident.
But why wait until you're 6 miles off campus to die? I asked. He sighed and shook his head.
She did like being mysterious. Maybe she wanted it like this.
I laughed then, and the colonel said,
What?
I was just thinking, why do you run head-on into a cop car with its lights on? And then I thought, well, she hated authority figures. The colonel laughed. Hey, look at that, Pudge made a funny. It felt almost normal, and then my distance from the event itself seemed to evaporate, and I found myself back in the gym, hearing the news for the first time, the Eagle's tears dripping onto his pants, and I looked over at the colonel and thought of all the hours we'd spent on this foam couch in the past 2 weeks, everything she'd ruined. Too pissed off to cry, I said, this is only making me hate her. I don't want to hate her. And what's the point if that's all it's making me do? Still refusing to answer how and why questions, still insisting on an aura of mystery. I leaned forward, head between my knees, and the colonel placed a hand on my upper back. The point is that there are always answers, Pudge. And then he pushed air out between his pursed lips, and I could hear the angry quiver in his voice as he repeated, there are always answers. We just have to be smart enough. The web says that suicides usually involve carefully thought-out plans, so clearly she did not commit suicide. I felt embarrassed to be still falling apart 2 weeks later when the colonel could take his medicine so stoically, and I sat up. Okay, fine, I answered. It wasn't suicide. Although it sure doesn't make sense as an accident, the colonel said. I laughed. We sure are making progress. We were interrupted by Holly Moser, the senior I knew primarily from viewing her nude self-portraits over Thanksgiving with Alaska. Holly hung with the weekday warriors, which explains why I'd previously said about 2 words to her in my life, but she just came in without knocking and said she'd had a mystical indicator of Alaska's presence. I was in the Waffle House, and suddenly all the lights went off, except for, like, the light over my booth, which started flashing. It would be, like, on for a second, and then off for a while, and then on for a couple of seconds, and then off. And I realized, you know, it was Alaska. I think she was trying to talk to me in Morse code, but, like, I don't know Morse code. She probably didn't know that. Anyway, I thought you guys should know. Thanks, I said curtly. And she stood for a while, looking at us, her mouth opening as if to speak, but the colonel was staring at her through half-closed eyes, his jaw jutting out and his distaste uncontained. I understood how he felt. I didn't believe in ghosts who used Morse code to communicate with people they'd never liked. And I disliked the possibility that Alaska would give someone else peace, but not me.
God, people like that shouldn't be allowed to live, he said after she left. It was pretty stupid. It's not just stupid, Pudge. I mean, as if Alaska would talk to Holly Moser. God, I can't stand these fake grievers, stupid bitch.
I almost told him that Alaska wouldn't want him to call any woman a bitch, but there was no use fighting with the colonel. 20 days after. It was Sunday, and the colonel and I decided against the cafeteria for dinner. Instead, walking off campus and across Highway 119 to the sunny convenience kiosk, where we indulged in a well-balanced meal of 2 oatmeal cream pies apiece. 700 calories, enough energy to sustain a man for half a day. We sat on the curb in front of the store, and I finished dinner in 4 bites. I'm going to call Jake tomorrow, just so you know. I got his phone number from Takumi. Fine, I said.
I heard a bell jangle behind me and turned toward the opening door. "Y'all's loitering," said the woman who'd just sold us dinner.
"We're eating," the colonel answered.
The woman shook her head and ordered, as if to a dog, "Git!" So we walked behind the store and sat by the stinking, fetid dumpster.
"Enough with the fines already, Pudge. That's ridiculous. I'm going to call Jake, and I'm going to write down everything he says. And then we're going to sit down together and try and figure out what happened."
No, you're on your own with that. I don't want to know what happened between her and Jake. The colonel sighed and pulled a pack of Pudge Fund cigarettes out of his jeans pocket.
Why not?
Because I don't want to. Do I have to provide you with an in-depth analysis of every decision I make?
The colonel lit the cigarette with a lighter I'd paid for and took a drag.
Whatever. It needs to be figured out, and I need your help to do it. Because between the two of us, we knew her pretty well, so that's that.
I stood up and stared down at him sitting smugly, and he blew a thin stream of smoke at my face, and I'd had enough.
"I'm tired of following orders, asshole. I'm not going to sit with you and discuss the finer points of her relationship with Jake, goddammit. I can't say it any clearer. I don't want to know about them. I already know what she told me, and that's all I need to know. And you can be a condescending prick as long as you'd like, but I'm not going to sit around and chat with you about how goddamn much she loved Jake. Now give me my cigarettes."
The colonel threw the pack on the ground and was up in a flash, a fistful of my sweater in his hand, trying but failing to pull me down to his height.
"You don't even care about her," he shouted. "All that matters is you and your precious fucking fantasy that you and Alaska had this goddamn secret love affair, and she was going to leave Jake for you, and you'd live happily ever after. But she kissed a lot of guys, Pudge. And if she were here, we both know that she would still be Jake's girlfriend, and that there'd be nothing but drama between the two of you. Not love, not sex, just you pining after her, and her like, 'You're cute, Pudge, but I love Jake.' If she loved you so much, why did she leave you that night? And if you loved her so much, why'd you help her go? I was drunk. What's your excuse?"
The colonel let go of my sweater, and I reached down and picked up the cigarettes. Not screaming, not through clenched teeth, not with the veins pulsing in my forehead, but calmly. Calmly. I looked down at the colonel and said, "Fuck you." The vein-pulsing screaming came later, after I had jogged across Highway 119 and through the dorm circle and across the soccer field and down the dirt road to the bridge, when I found myself at the smoking hole. I picked up a blue chair and threw it against the concrete wall, and the clang of plastic on concrete echoed beneath the bridge as the chair fell limply on its side, and then I lay on my back with my knees hanging over the precipice and screamed. I screamed because the colonel was a self-satisfied, condescending bastard, and I screamed because he was right, for I did want to believe that I'd had a secret love affair with Alaska. Did she love me? Would she have left Jake for me? Or was it just another impulsive Alaska moment? It was not enough to be the last guy she kissed. I wanted to be the last one she loved, and I knew I wasn't. I knew it, and I hated her for it. I hated her for not caring about me. I hated her for leaving that night, and I hated myself, too, not only because I let her go, but because if I had been enough for her, she wouldn't have even wanted to leave. She would have just lain with me and talked and cried, and I would have listened and kissed at her tears as they pooled in her eyes. I turned my head and looked at one of the little blue plastic chairs on its side. I wondered if there would ever be a day when I didn't think about Alaska. Wondered whether I should hope for a time when she would be a distant memory, recalled only on the anniversary of her death, or maybe a couple of weeks after, remembering only after having forgotten. I knew that I would know more dead people. The bodies would pile up. Could there be a space in my memory for each of them, or would I forget a little of Alaska every day for the rest of my life? Once, early on in the year, she and I had walked down to the smoking hole, and she jumped into Culver Creek with her flip-flops still on. She stepped across the creek, picking her steps carefully over the mossy rocks, and grabbed a waterlogged stick from the creek bank. As I sat on the concrete, my feet dangling toward the water, she overturned rocks with the stick and pointed out the skittering crawfish. "You boil 'em, then suck the heads out," she said excitedly. "That's where all the good stuff is, the heads." She taught me everything I knew about crawfish and kissing and pink wine and poetry. She made me different. I lit a cigarette and spit into the creek. "You can't just make me different and then leave," I said out loud to her. "Because I was fine before, Alaska. I was fine with just me and last words and school friends, and you can't just make me different and then die." For she had embodied the great perhaps. She had proved to me that it was worth it to leave behind my minor life for grander maybes, and now she was gone, and with her, my faith in perhaps. I could call everything the colonel said and did fine. I could try to pretend that I didn't care anymore, but it could never be true again. You can't just make yourself matter and then die, Alaska, because now I am irretrievably different, and I'm sorry I let you go, yes, but you made the choice. You left me perhapsless, stuck in your goddamned labyrinth,
and now I don't even know if you chose the straight and fast way out, if you left me like this on purpose. And so I never knew you, did I? I can't remember, because I never knew. And as I stood up to walk home and make my peace with the colonel, I tried to imagine her in that chair, but I could not remember whether she crossed her legs. I could still see her smiling at me with half of Mona Lisa's smirk, but I couldn't picture her hands well enough to see her holding a cigarette. I needed, I decided, to really know her, because I needed more to remember. Before I could begin the shameful process of forgetting the how and the why of her living and dying, I needed to learn it. How, why, when, where, what. At room 43, after quickly offered and accepted apologies, the colonel said, "We've made a tactical decision to push back calling Jake. We're going to pursue some other avenues first." 21 days after. As Dr. Hyde shuffled into class the next morning, Takumi sat down next to me and wrote a note on the edge of his notebook. "Lunch at Mick Inedible," it read. I scribbled okay on my own notebook and then turned to a blank page as Dr. Hyde started talking about Sufism, the mystical sect of Islam. I'd only scanned through the reading. I'd been studying only enough not to fail, but in my scanning, I'd come across great last words. This poor Sufi, dressed in rags, walked into a jewelry store owned by a rich merchant and asked him, "Do you know how you're going to die?" The merchant answered, "No, no one knows how they're going to die." And the Sufi said, "I do." "How?" asked the merchant. And the Sufi lay down, crossed his arms, said, "Like this," and died. Whereupon the merchant promptly gave up his store to live a life of poverty in pursuit of the kind of spiritual wealth the dead Sufi had acquired. But Dr. Hyde was telling a different story, one that I'd skipped.
"Karl Marx famously called religion the opiate of the masses. Buddhism, particularly as it is popularly practiced, promises improvement through karma. Islam and Christianity promise eternal paradise to the faithful, and that is a powerful opiate, certainly, the hope of a better life to come. But there's a Sufi story that challenges the notion that people believe only because they need an opiate. Rabia al-Adawiya, a great woman saint of Sufism, was seen running through the streets of her hometown, Basra, carrying a torch in one hand and a bucket of water in the other. When someone asked her what she was doing, she answered, 'I am going to take this bucket of water and pour it on the flames of hell, and then I am going to use this torch to burn down the gates of paradise, so that people will not love God for want of heaven or fear of hell, but because he is God.'"
A woman so strong she burns heaven and drenches hell. Alaska would have liked this Rabia woman, I wrote in my notebook. But even so, the afterlife mattered to me. Heaven and hell and reincarnation. As much as I wanted to know how Alaska had died, I wanted to know where she was now, if anywhere. I liked to imagine her looking down on us, still aware of us, but it seemed like a fantasy, and I never really felt it. Just as the colonel had said at the funeral that she wasn't there, she wasn't anywhere. I couldn't honestly imagine her as anything but dead, her body rotting in Vine Station, the rest of her just a ghost, alive only in our remembering. Like Rabia, I didn't think people should believe in God because of heaven and hell, but I didn't feel a need to run around with a torch. You can't burn down a made-up place. After class, as Takumi picked through his fries at Mick Inedible, eating only the crunchiest, I felt the total loss of her, still reeling from the idea that she was not only gone from this world, but from all of them. "How have you been?" I asked. He said with a mouthful of fries.
"Not good. You?"
"Not good." I took a bite of cheeseburger. I'd gotten a plastic stock car with my Happy Meal, and it sat overturned on the table. I spun the wheels.
"I miss her,"
Takumi said, pushing away his tray, uninterested in the remaining soggy fries.
Yeah, I do too. I'm sorry, Takumi. And I meant it in the largest possible way. I was sorry we ended up like this, spinning wheels at a McDonald's. Sorry the person who had brought us together now lay dead between us. I was sorry I let her die. Sorry I haven't talked to you because you couldn't know the truth about the Colonel and me, and I hated being around you and having to pretend that my grief is this uncomplicated thing, pretending that she died and I miss her, instead of that she died because of me, I thought.
Me too. You're not dating Lara anymore, are you?
I don't think so.
Okay. She was kind of wondering.
I had been ignoring her, but by then she had begun to ignore me back, so I figured it was over, but maybe not. Well, I told Takumi, I just can't... I don't know, man, that's pretty complicated.
Sure. She'll understand. Sure, all good.
Okay.
Listen, Pudge, I don't know. It sucks, huh?
Yeah. 27 days after. 6 days later, 4 Sundays after the last Sunday, the Colonel and I were trying to shoot each other with paintball guns while turning 900s in a halfpipe.
We need booze. And we need to borrow the Eagle's breathalyzer.
Borrow it? Do you know where it is?
Yeah. He's never made you take one?
No. He thinks I'm a nerd.
You are a nerd, Pudge. But you're not going to let a detail like that keep you from drinking.
Actually, I hadn't drunk since that night, and didn't feel particularly inclined to ever take it up ever again. Then, I nearly elbowed the Colonel in the face, swinging my arms wildly, as if contorting my body in the right ways mattered as much as pressing the right buttons at the right moments, the same video game playing delusion that had always gripped Alaska. But the Colonel was so focused on the game, he didn't even notice. Do you have a plan for how exactly we're going to steal the breathalyzer from inside the Eagle's house? The Colonel looked over at me and said,
Do you suck at this game?
And then, without turning back to the screen, shot my skater in the balls with a blue paint blast.
But first, we gotta get some liquor, because the ambrosia's sour, and my booze connection is...
Poof. Gone, I finished. When I opened his door, Takumi was sitting at his desk, boxy headphones surrounding his entire head, bouncing his head to the beat. He seemed oblivious to us.
Hey, I said.
Nothing.
Takumi.
Nothing.
Takumi!
He turned around and pulled off his headphones. I closed the door behind me and said,
You got any alcohol?
Why? He asked.
Because we want to get drunk, the Colonel answered.
Great, I'll join you.
Takumi, the Colonel said, we need to do this alone.
No, I've had enough of that shit.
Takumi stood up, walked into his bathroom, and came out with a Gatorade bottle filled with clear liquid.
I keep it in the medicine cabinet, Takumi said, on account of how it's medicine.
He pocketed the bottle and then walked out of the room, leaving the door open behind him. A moment later, he peeked his head back in and, brilliantly mimicking the Colonel's bossy bass voice, said,
Christ, you coming or what? Takumi, the Colonel said. Okay, look, what we're doing is a little dangerous, and I don't want you caught up in it, honestly. But listen, we'll tell you everything starting tomorrow.
I'm tired of all this secret shit. She was my friend, too.
Tomorrow, honestly.
He pulled the bottle out of his pocket and tossed it to me.
Tomorrow, he said.
I don't really want him to know, I said as we walked back to the room, the Gatorade bottle stuffed in the pocket of my sweatshirt. He'll hate us.
Yeah, well, he'll hate us more if we keep pretending he doesn't exist, the Colonel answered.
15 minutes later, I stood at the Eagle's doorstep. He opened the door with a spatula in hand, smiled, and said,
Miles, come in. I was just making an egg sandwich. Want one?
No, thanks, I said, following the Eagle into his kitchen. My job was to keep him out of his living room for 30 seconds so the Colonel could get the breathalyzer undetected. I coughed loudly to let the Colonel know the coast was clear. The Eagle picked up his egg sandwich and took a bite.
To what do I owe the pleasure of your visit? He asked.
I just wanted to tell you that the Colonel, I mean, Chip Martin, he's my roommate, you know, he's having a tough time in Latin.
Well, he's not attending the class, from what I understand, which can make it very difficult to learn the language.
He walked toward me. I coughed again and backpedaled, the eagle and I tangoing our way toward his living room.
Right, well, he's up all night every night thinking about Alaska, I said, standing up straight and tall, trying to block the eagle's view of the living room with my none-too-wide shoulders. They were very close, you know.
I know that, he said,
and in the living room, the colonel's sneakers squeaked against the hardwood floor. The eagle looked at me quizzically and sidestepped me. I quickly said, "Is that burner on?" and pointed toward the frying pan. The eagle wheeled around, looked at the clearly not on burner, then dashed into the living room.
Empty. He turned back to me. Are you up to something, Miles?
No, sir. Honestly, I just wanted to talk about Chip.
He arched his eyebrows, skeptical.
Well, I understand that this is a devastating loss for Alaska's close friends. It's just awful. There's no comfort to this grief, is there?
No, sir.
I'm sympathetic to Chip's troubles, but school is important. Alaska would have wanted, I'm sure, for Chip's studies to continue unimpeded.
I'm sure, I thought. I thanked the eagle, and he promised me an egg sandwich at some point in the future, which made me nervous that he would just show up at our room one afternoon with an egg sandwich in hand to find us A, illegally smoking, while the Colonel B, illegally drank milk and vodka out of a gallon jug. Halfway across the dorm circle, the colonel ran up to me.
That was smooth, with the "is that burner on?" If you hadn't pulled that, I was toast. Although, I guess I'll have to start going to Latin. Stupid Latin.
Did you get it? I asked.
Yeah, he said. Yeah, God, I hope he doesn't go looking for it tonight. Although, really, he could never suspect anything. Why would someone steal a breathalyzer?
At 2 o'clock in the morning, the colonel took his sixth shot of vodka, grimaced, then frantically motioned with his hand toward the bottle of Mountain Dew I was drinking. I handed it to him, and he took a long pull on it.
I don't think I'll be able to go to Latin tomorrow, he said. His words were slightly slurred, as if his tongue were swollen.
One more, I pleaded.
Okay, this is it, though.
He poured a sip of vodka into a Dixie cup, swallowed, pursed his lips, and squeezed his hands into tight little fists.
Oh, God, this is bad. It's so much better with milk. This better be 0.24.
We have to wait for 15 minutes after your last drink before we test it, I said, having downloaded instructions for the breathalyzer off the internet.
Do you feel drunk? If drunk were cookies, I'd be Famous Amos.
We laughed.
Chips Ahoy would have been funnier, I said. Forgive me, not at my best.
I held the breathalyzer in my hand, a sleek silver gadget about the size of a small remote control. Beneath an LCD screen was a small hole. I blew into it to test it. 0.00, it read. I figured it was working. After 15 minutes, I handed it to the colonel. Blow really hard into it for at least 2 seconds, I said. He looked up at me.
Is that what you told Laura in the TV room? Because, see, Pudge, they only call it a blowjob.
Shut up and blow, I said. His cheeks puffed out, and the colonel blew into the hole hard and long, his face turning red.
0.16. Oh, no, the colonel said. Oh, God.
You're 2/3 of the way there, I said encouragingly.
Yeah, but I'm like 3/4 of the way to puking.
Well, obviously it's possible. She did it. Come on, you can outdrink a girl, can't you?
Give me the Mountain Dew, he said stoically.
And then I heard footsteps outside. Footsteps. We'd waited till 1 o'clock to turn on the lights, figuring everyone would be long asleep. It was a school night, after all. But footsteps. Shit.
and as the colonel looked at me confused, I grabbed the breathalyzer from him and stuffed it between the foam cushions of the couch and grabbed the Dixie cup and the Gatorade bottle of vodka and stashed them behind the coffee table, and in one motion I grabbed a cigarette from a pack and lit it, hoping the smell of smoke would cover up the smell of booze. I puffed the cigarette without inhaling, trying to smoke up the room, and I was almost back to the couch when the three quick knocks came against the door, and the colonel looked at me, his eyes wide, his suddenly unpromising future flashing before his eyes, and I whispered, "Cry," as the eagle turned the knob. The colonel hunched forward, his head between his knees and his shoulders shaking, and I put my arm around him as the eagle came in. "I'm sorry," I said before the eagle could say anything. "He's having a tough night."
"Are you smoking?" the eagle asked. "In your room, 4 hours after lights out?"
I dropped the cigarette into a half-empty Coke can.
"I'm sorry, sir. I'm just trying to stay awake with him."
The eagle walked up toward the couch, and I felt the colonel start to rise, but I held his shoulders down firmly, because if the eagle smelled the colonel's breath, we were done for sure.
"Miles," the eagle said, "I understand that this is a difficult time for you, but you will respect the rules of this school or you will matriculate someplace else. I'll see you in jury tomorrow. Is there anything I can do for you, Chip?"
Without looking up, the colonel answered in a quivering, tear-soaked voice,
"No, sir. I'm just glad I have Miles."
"Well, I am too," the eagle said. "Perhaps you should encourage him to live within the confines of our rules, lest he risk his place on this campus."
"Yes, sir," the colonel said.
"Y'all can leave your lights on until you're ready to go to bed. I'll see you tomorrow, Miles."
"Good night, sir," I said, imagining the colonel sneaking the breathalyzer back into the eagle's house while I got harangued at jury. As the eagle closed the door behind him, the colonel shot up, smiling at me, and still nervous that the eagle might be outside, whispered,
"That was a thing of beauty."
"I learned from the best," I said. "Now drink." An hour later, the Gatorade bottle mostly empty, the colonel hit .24.
"Thank you, Jesus," he exclaimed, and then added, "This is awful. This is not fun drunk."
I got up and cleared the coffee table out of the way so the colonel could walk the length of the room without hitting any obstacles, and said, "Okay, can you stand?" The colonel pushed his arms into the foam of the couch and began to rise, but then fell backward onto the couch, lying on his back.
"Spinning room," he observed. "Gonna puke."
"Don't puke. That will ruin everything." I decided to give him a field sobriety test like the cops do. "Okay, get over here and try to walk a straight line." He rolled off the couch and fell to the floor, and I caught him beneath his armpits and held him up. I positioned him in between two tiles of the linoleum floor. "Follow that line of tiles. Walk straight, toe to heel." He raised one leg and immediately leaned to the left, his arms windmilling. He took a single unsteady step, sort of a waddle, as his feet were seemingly unable to land directly in front of each other. He regained his balance briefly, then took a step backward and landed on the couch.
"I fail," he said matter-of-factly.
"Okay, how's your depth perception?"
"My what perception?"
"Look at me. Is there one of me? Are there two of me? Could you accidentally drive into me if I were a cop car?"
"Everything's very spinny, but I don't think so. This is bad. Was she really like this?"
"Apparently. Could you drive like this?"
"Oh, God, no, no. She was really drunk, huh?"
"Yeah."
"We were really stupid."
"Yeah."
"I'm spinning, but no. No cop car. I can see."
"So there's your evidence."
"Maybe she fell asleep. I feel awfully sleepy."
"We'll find out," I said, trying to play the role that the colonel had always played for me.
"Not tonight," he answered. "Tonight we're going to throw up a little, and then we are going to sleep through our hangover.
Don't forget about Latin."
"Right. Fucking Latin."
28 days after. the colonel made it to Latin the next morning.
I feel awesome right now because I'm still drunk, but God help me in a couple of hours.
And I took a French test for which I had studied un petit peu. I did all right on the multiple choice, which verb tense makes sense here type questions, but the essay question. In Le Petit Prince, what is the significance of the rose threw me a bit. Had I read The Little Prince in English or French, I suspect this question might have been quite easy. Unfortunately, I'd spent the evening getting the colonel drunk. So I answered, Elle symbolise l'amour. It symbolizes love. Madame O'Malley had left us with an entire page to answer the question, but I figured I'd covered it nicely in three words. I'd kept up in my classes well enough to get B-minuses and not worry my parents, but I didn't really care much anymore. The significance of the rose, I thought, who gives a shit? What's the significance of the white tulips? There was a question worth answering. After I'd gotten a lecture and 10 work hours at jury, I came back to room 43 to find the colonel telling Takumi everything. Well, everything except the kiss. I walked into the colonel saying,
So we helped her go.
You set off the fireworks? He said.
How'd you know about the fireworks?
I've been doing a bit of investigating, Takumi answered.
Well, anyway, that was dumb. You shouldn't have done it.
But we all let her go, really, he said, and I wondered what the hell he meant by that. But I didn't have time to ask before he said to me,
So you think it was a suicide?
Maybe, I said. I don't see how she could have hit the cop car by accident unless she was asleep.
Maybe she was going to visit her father, Takumi said. Vine Station is on the way.
Maybe, I said. Everything's a maybe, isn't it? The colonel reached in his pocket for a pack of cigarettes.
Well, here's another one. Maybe Jake has the answers, he said. We've exhausted other strategies, so I'm calling him tomorrow, okay?
I wanted answers now, too, but not to some questions.
Yeah, okay, I said. But listen, don't tell me anything that's not relevant. I don't want to know anything unless it's going to help me know where she was going and why.
Me neither, actually, Takumi said. I feel like maybe some of that shit should stay private.
The colonel stuffed a towel under the door, lit a cigarette, and said,
Fair enough, kids. We'll work on a need-to-know basis.
29 days after. As I walked home from classes the next day, I saw the colonel sitting on the bench outside the payphone, scribbling into a notebook balanced on his knees as he cradled the phone between his ear and shoulder. I hurried into room 43, where I found Takumi playing the racing game on mute.
How long has he been on the phone? I asked. Dunno. He was on when I got here 20 minutes ago. He must have skipped smart boy math. Why, are you scared Jake's going to drive down here and kick your ass for letting her go?
Whatever, I said, thinking, this is precisely why we shouldn't have told him.
I walked into the bathroom, turned on the shower, and lit a cigarette. Takumi came in not long after.
What's up? He said.
Nothing. I just want to know what happened to her.
Like you really want to know the truth? Or like you want to find out that she fought with him and was on her way to break up with him and was going to come back here and fall into your arms and you were going to make hot, sweet love and have genius babies who memorized last words and poetry?
If you're pissed at me, just say so.
I'm not pissed at you for letting her go, but I'm tired of you acting like you were the only guy who ever wanted her, like you had some monopoly on liking her,
Takumi answered.
I stood up, lifted the toilet seat, and flushed my unfinished cigarette. I stared at him for a moment, and then said, I kissed her that night, and I've got a monopoly on that.
What?
He stammered. I kissed her. His mouth opened as if to speak, but he said nothing. We stared at each other for a while, and I felt ashamed of myself for what amounted to bragging, and finally I said, Look, you know how she was. She wanted to do something, and she did it. I was probably just the guy who happened to be there.
Yeah. Well, I was never that guy, he said.
Well, Pudge, God knows I can't blame you.
Don't tell Lara. He was nodding as we heard the three quick knocks on the front door that meant the eagle, and I thought, shit, caught twice in a week, and Takumi pointed into the shower, and so we jumped in together and pulled the curtain shut, the too low shower head spitting water onto us from ribcage down. Forced to stand closer together than seemed entirely necessary, we stayed there, silent, the sputtering shower slowly soaking our t-shirts and jeans for a few long minutes while we waited for the steam to lift the smoke into the vents. But the eagle never knocked on the bathroom door, and eventually Takumi turned off the shower. I opened the bathroom door a crack and peeked out to see the colonel sitting on the foam couch, his feet propped up on the coffee table, finishing Takumi's NASCAR race. I opened the door, and Takumi and I walked out, fully clothed and dripping wet.
"Well, there's something you don't see every day," the colonel said nonchalantly.
"What the hell?" I asked.
"I knocked like the eagle to scare you."
He smiled.
"But shit, if you all need privacy, just leave a note on the door next time."
Takumi and I laughed, and then Takumi said, "Yeah, Pudge and I were getting a little testy, but man, ever since we showered together, Pudge, I feel really close to you." "So how'd it go?" I asked. I sat down on the coffee table, and Takumi plopped down on the couch next to the colonel, both of us wet and vaguely cold, but more concerned with the colonel's talk with Jake than with getting dry.
"It was interesting. Here's what you need to know. He gave her those flowers like we thought. They didn't fight. He just called because he had promised to call at the exact moment of their 8-month anniversary, which happened to be 3:02 in the a.m., which, let's agree, is a little ridiculous. And I guess somehow she heard the phone ringing. So they talked about nothing for like 5 minutes, and then completely out of nowhere, she freaked out."
"Completely out of nowhere?" Takumi asked.
"Allow me to consult my notes." The colonel flipped through his notebook. "Okay. Jake says, 'Did you have a nice anniversary?' And then Alaska says, 'I had a splendid anniversary.'
And I could hear in the colonel's reading the excitement of her voice, the way she leaped onto certain words like splendid and fantastic and absolutely.
Then it's quiet. Then Jake says, 'What are you doing?' And Alaska says, 'Nothing, just doodling.' And then she says, 'Oh, God.' And then she says, 'Shit, shit, shit,' and starts sobbing and told him she had to go, but she'd talk to him later.
But she didn't say she was driving to see him, and Jake doesn't think she was. He doesn't know where she was going. But he says that she always asked if she could come up to see him, and she didn't ask, so she must not have been coming. Hold on, let me find the quote." He flipped a page in the notebook.
"Okay, here. She said she'd talk to me later, not that she'd see me."
"She tells me to be continued, and tells Jake she'll talk to him later," I observed.
"Yes, noted. Planning for a future. Admittedly inconsistent with suicide. So then she comes back into her room, screaming about forgetting something. And then her headlong race comes to its end, so no answers, really."
"Well, we know where she wasn't going."
"Unless she was feeling particularly impulsive," Takumi said. He looked at me. "And from the sound of things, she was feeling rather impulsive that night."
The colonel looked over at me curiously, and I nodded. "Yeah," Takumi said, "I know."
"Okay, then. And you were pissed, but then you took a shower with Pudge and it's all good. Excellent. So that night," the colonel continued,
"and we tried to resurrect the conversation that last night as best we could for Takumi, but neither of us remembered it terribly well, partly because the colonel was drunk and I wasn't paying attention until she brought up Truth or Dare. And anyway, we didn't know how much it might mean. Last words are always harder to remember when no one knows that someone's about to die."
"I mean," the colonel said, "I think she and I were talking about how much I adored skateboarding on the computer, but how it would never even occur to me to try and step on a skateboard in real life. And then she said, 'Let's play Truth or Dare,' and then you fucked her."
"Wait, you fucked her? In front of the colonel?"
Takumi cried.
"I didn't fuck her."
"Calm down, guys," the colonel said, throwing up his hands. "It's a euphemism."
"For what?"
Takumi asked.
"Kissing."
"Brilliant euphemism."
Takumi rolled his eyes.
"Am I the only one who thinks that might be significant?"
"Yeah,
That never occurred to me before, I deadpanned. But now I don't know. She didn't tell Jake. It couldn't have been that important. Maybe she was racked with guilt, he said.
Jake said she seemed normal on the phone before she freaked out, the colonel said.
But it must have been that phone call. Something happened that we aren't seeing.
The colonel ran his hands through his thick hair, frustrated.
Christ, something. Something inside of her. And now we just have to figure out what that was.
So we just have to read the mind of a dead person, Takumi said. Easy enough.
Precisely. Want to get shit-faced? The colonel asked.
I don't feel like drinking, I said.
The colonel reached into the foam recesses of the couch and pulled out Takumi's Gatorade bottle. Takumi didn't want any either, but the colonel just smirked and said, "More for me," and chugged.
37 days after. The next Wednesday, I ran into Lara after religion class, literally. I'd seen her, of course. I'd seen her almost every day, in English or sitting in the library whispering to her roommate Katie. I saw her at lunch and dinner at the cafeteria, and I probably would have seen her at breakfast if I'd ever gotten up for it. And surely she saw me as well, but we hadn't until that morning looked at each other simultaneously. By now, I assumed she'd forgotten me. After all, we only dated for about a day, albeit an eventful one. But when I plowed right into her left shoulder as I hustled toward pre-calc, she spun around and looked up at me, angry, and not because of the bump.
"I'm sorry," I blurted out, and she just squinted at me like someone about to either fight or cry, and disappeared silently into a classroom. First two words I'd said to her in a month. I wanted to talk to her. I knew I'd been awful. Imagine, I kept telling myself, if you were Lara with a dead friend and a silent ex-boyfriend. But I only had room for one true want, and she was dead. And I wanted to know the how and why of it, and Lara couldn't tell me. And that was all that mattered.
This is the end of disc number 5. Please continue listening on disc number 6.